This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the world faces the largest humanitarian crisis since 1945. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. According to the United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator, Stephen O'Brien, more than 20 million people across four countries in Africa and the Middle East are at risk of starvation and famine. O'Brien called the crisis the largest in the history of the United Nations and said that without collective and coordinated global efforts, people will simply starve to death. He told the UN Security Council earlier this month that $4.4 billion were needed to combat extreme hunger in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, and Northeast Nigeria. Millions of people in these countries are facing food shortages and starvation stemming from a deep drought and or years of devastating conflict. So with us to discuss the humanitarian and political implications of this global humanitarian crisis are two distinguished experts. J. Peter Pham is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. Pham is the author of over a dozen books on African history and politics and a frequent analyst at these VOA microphones. And Michel Gabaudon. He's president of Refugees International. That's an independent advocacy group based here in Washington. He previously served with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees for over 25 years. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, J. Peter Pham, let me begin with you. Do you agree with this UN assessment that this is indeed the largest humanitarian crisis since the inception of the United Nations in 1945?
Well, I tend to shy away from claims of absolute. However, there's no doubt that this is a very significant crisis, one that in many respects is all the more tragic by the fact that it is driven primarily by man-made causes. Certainly there are climatological and meteorological conditions, and we can get into that. But what's common to all four of these countries, northeastern Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen, is that the natural occurring tragedies have been exacerbated by the human tragedy of conflicts driven by humans, and in some cases exacerbated even further by politics.
Turning to you, Michel Gabaudon, for your interpretation of where we are today with this global humanitarian crisis, to what extent has it been exacerbated by political conditions, man-made causes?
Well, I think it's a mixture of the two. The countries that were mentioned have been hit by droughts over the past century, but the cycle of droughts was much longer than it is now. Droughts are recurring more often. The last time we spoke of a drought in Somalia, for example, was in 2011, just barely 6 years ago. So there is an acceleration of the process, which we could talk about the causes, etc. And then I certainly agree with Peter that political malfunction is adding tremendous injury to this phenomenon because it complicates the ability of governments to address the issue and it complicates the ability of those who want to help to provide that help in a timely and appropriate manner.
Turning back to you, Peter Pham, there were many signs for warning this famine, and of course we know the conflict, whether in northeast Nigeria, Yemen, South Sudan has been simply grinding on for so many years. Why did the international community not, you know, act sooner, in your view, and what are the factors?
The international community has a series of very sophisticated early warning mechanisms, and in fact, many of these did sound the alarm, and certainly beginning with northeastern Nigeria, let's speak to that, bells have been ringing for some time. I was out in northeastern Nigeria just a few months ago and saw for myself, it was quite evident what was happening there. But unfortunately, we live in a world in a time when things are driven by images. And all too often, unfortunately, it's out of sight, out of mind. We have other things in the news cycle, and it's unfortunate that these warning bells that the international community has received were not perhaps given the attention that they needed to be. But as Michelle rightly pointed out, there are long-term causes to this as well. In northeastern Nigeria, Lake Chad is just a small fraction of what it once was. It's shrunken. That has affected not only livelihoods, fisheries, but also the possibilities of irrigation. And so the land itself has changed. Certainly the conflict with Boko Haram and the ongoing insecurity, the government may have driven back the insurgents, but the security both for the people to return to work the land and also for humanitarian groups to access those people, that still remains an issue. In South Sudan, the issue is a little different. It's a conflict driven by political elites, which has turned one of Africa's most arable spaces, undercultivated, underutilized arable land masses, into a place of hunger where upwards of 5 million people risk severe food insecurities this year. And we have a government in place that is thinking to profit off this by raising the visas for humanitarian workers coming to help them from $100 to $10,000. It's absolutely unconscionable.
It sounds that way, indeed, and we're going to get into the specific cases further into the program. But let me turn back to Michel Gabaldon for your interpretation of why it took this long. Why do we have to read these devastating headlines? Why the delay in terms of collective action?
Well, the international communities were already facing challenges before the famine came out on the scene, if you want. I mean, since 2 years ago, we talk about the level of internal displacement and refugee problems that have reached proportions not heard of since the Second World War. And the funding for these programs was, despite efforts of the international community, well below the needs. So the international community had difficulties to catch up with the situation as it was about 2 years ago. Now you have additional challenges coming up, which require, obviously, additional funding. And everybody's looking a little bit to who is going to bleep first and to start putting the succor. The U.S. has been traditionally the lead donor in these programs. And I really want to caution that when we talk about famine, we immediately think about food. You need food for famine, but you need cash because you need to have programs that address water and sanitation, that address healthcare, etc. You don't treat a famine just by providing food. So the challenges now is really, are we going to be able to muster the financial resources at short notice that are required? And I don't think we have an answer as yet.
Well, that leads me to ask you, J. Peter Pham, what are the implications now? We have an administration who just introduced a budget. We know that the budget is simply a blueprint. It's not going to necessarily be the final one. And a budget which really gives short shrift to international agencies, the United Nations. What are the implications of that, of our current political situation, for the fact that the United States has been the largest donor?
Well, for the immediate crisis at hand, the four countries that we're discussing, not much in the immediate, because the current fiscal year began October 1, 2016, so we're operating with a budget that is already in the book. So what needs to be done right now is going to be done with what was already passed. I think what we have to study is what the final form of the budget for fiscal year 2018, which begins October 1 of this year, which Congress has yet to act on, and the administration has yet to present the very detail, the fine print, that's going to have implications certainly for later this year and the years ahead. And I think that's what we need to be thinking of. But for the immediate crisis on hand, the resources such as they are have been allocated, and perhaps there may be a call or a need for additional appropriation supplementals as we become more cognizant of the process. But I would be hesitant to draw too quick of a line between the current crisis and the funding proposals for future years.
Turning back to you, Michel Gabaldon, as I said in the introduction, Stephen O'Brien, the UN humanitarian coordinator, told the UN Security Council that $4.4 billion were needed to combat hunger in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, and Northeast Nigeria. Based on what you just said, that the United States is traditionally the lead donor, and given our political context, how do you see, you know, being able to raise this money, not just immediately, but for the future? And what about other nation states that you think can and should step up to the plate in addition to the United States?
Well, when we see the draft budget, we, of course, all got a thrill saying what is going to happen. It was quite reassuring to see that many within the Republican Party did oppose that, that many among ex-generals have made it very clear for them that U.S. soft power is just as important as its military power. And I hope that when the final decisions are made, we are going to get back to the traditional leadership that the U.S. has demonstrated in a bipartisan way over the past decades. Other countries, yes, I mean, the EU would be the second largest donor. It now faces its own challenges with the movements inside Europe, so its attention is slightly diverted. And I know that there has been a lot of pressure put on the Gulf states, for example, to contribute more. And the U.S., to be honest, has tried very hard, so has the current Secretary General, to try to bring them on. And there has been some moves recently, I mean, perhaps not to the extent that we would hope. But when I come to the U.S. contribution, I think it's important to recall the U.S. gives about 1% of GDP in foreign aid. It's good, but it's not as big as some other countries. The problem is because of the volume of the U.S. economy, that 1% means a tremendous amount of resources. And without that, the rest of the world will say, well, if the U.S. drops the ball, why should we go behind? I don't think we have now indications that there is any other country or region that is prepared to take over that leadership. And that's why we really hope that the U.S., despite the discussions that are going right now, will eventually go back to its traditional function of being the Western leader in humanitarian aid.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank here in Washington, and Michel Gabaudon. He's President of Refugees International and former Regional Representative with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees. And we are discussing the causes and consequences of the global humanitarian crisis afflicting countries in Africa and the Middle East. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Shaukat Ali. He's a fan from Bunarwal, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, J. Peter Pham. Let's drill down a little bit in each of the conflicts or each of these countries to see what's driving the crisis and how it can be remedied. Let's look at Yemen briefly. Because of the conflict, it's also dependent on imports for food, medicine, but of course the conflict is complicating all of this. Discuss what the factors are in Yemen that are driving this humanitarian crisis and how you see a way to break through.
In Yemen, we have a situation where the government has lost control of large sections of the country. That's the internationally recognized government. And in fact, most of the government bases itself in exile in Saudi Arabia. Large portions of the country have been overrun both by terrorists linked with Al-Qaeda, as well as rebels supported by Iran, the Houthis. And this has become a proxy conflict between the Sunni Arab countries and Shia Iran, each backing their own sides in this, and that has exacerbated the situation of insecurity. Now, Yemen, even in the best of times, is food insecure. It relies on imports to feed its citizens, but the conflict exacerbates the situation even further.
Turning to you, Michel Gabaudon, to add or subtract to what Peter just said, and also given the situation, how do you break through? Do you blame one side versus the other? I mean, could the Saudis conduct themselves differently? Looking at the parties to the conflict.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to respond to this famine, we talk a lot about the money because this is what the West can provide, the money and expertise and NGOs who provide assistance, etc. But we forget that there's another key aspect to providing relief is to have access to this population. And access, in most cases, will be determined by the willingness of governments and on the parties they are in conflict with to come to some sort of terms so we can help their people. Because we cannot here just talk about we have a challenge with the money and have in these countries different factions that do not see their own responsibility in facilitating the response that we want to try to provide. It's certainly a factor in countries where you have like the Houthis, you know, people who are supported by big international governments. It's more complicated in areas like Somalia, where access is very much constrained, despite a government that has come a long way, I think, to some sort of attempt at good governance, but that deals with an insurgency, the al-Shabaab, for example, that is completely inaccessible by any international power. But in the case of Yemen, as Peter said, it's a proxy war that is directed by countries that sit at the UN, etc., and should be able to come together to say there's a minimum we should guarantee to make sure that aid can be delivered, because there's no point having money if you cannot get to the people in the areas where they are at risk of starving.
Based on this dire report, do you see any movement by these parties?
Not now.
Well, let's turn now to Somalia, since you mentioned Somalia, Michel Gabaudon. Back to you, Peter Pham, to talk about the situation in Somalia. We have a 2-year drought leading to loss of crops, obviously livestock, and certainly lives of humans, and poor governance, inadequate international aid efforts. Your interpretation of the problem in Somalia?
The problem in Somalia is driven by the conflict, as Michelle mentioned, between the internationally recognized government in Mogadishu, which is supported and protected by the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM, and Shabaab, the al-Qaeda-linked terrorist insurgency that used to have control over large parts of the country, but still much reduced, but still operating, especially in the southern parts of the country, still very operative. And last time there was a major famine in Somalia, 5 years ago, in fact, access by Shabaab was a real issue, humanitarian access to those areas. This time around, I think Shabaab's current leader, Abu Ubaida, seems to have learned some lessons from his deceased predecessor. Recently, just this past week, Al-Furqan, the Shabaab radio station, has been broadcasting news of famine relief being provided by Shabaab. Now, from what I understand, much of that is taking relief from, and this is a problematic, taking relief from organizations distributing it as their own, politicizing it. But that enters into yet another complication we have, is even where access is given, to the extent to which humanitarian groups have to work with people who control the territory, including like Shabaab, and the restrictions that the international community understandably wants to put on any sort of relationship, much less payments to or use by al-Shabaab.
Of course, Michel Gabaudon, that leads us to that question. How can the international community provide aid and relief without inadvertently aiding militant groups such as al-Shabaab who seek to profit?
Well, it's a constant problem, and I think that the NGO and the UN are aware of the conditions that donors put upon them to avoid that these resources be used politically. In some cases, you manage to work in these areas. Some agencies have worked in Shabaab-controlled areas, distributing themselves the aid and not passing on to Shabaab. And that would, I think, respect the principles we have, as that it is the humanitarians who define who are the vulnerables and who gets the funds, and it's not those who have political interest. It's not possible in every area, but I think if we let some of the people in the field explain how they work, we have seen instances where you can distribute goods in areas controlled by these terrorist groups in ways that are reasonably guarantors of the independence of the humanitarian effort. But it's tremendously difficult. It needs constant supervision. I think it needs accountability. You need to ask the people who deliver the aid how they provide, but we must not just say, because this is a Shabaab area, we're not going to do anything down there. I think that would be irresponsible. We must face the difficulties and try to confront them as they come.
Turning back to you, J. Peter Pham, to talk about northern Nigeria. And we know Boko Haram certainly exacerbates the situation. But to what extent is the situation in northern Nigeria with respect to the famine related to the conflict with Boko Haram and environmental and drought conditions?
Well, I think there are several factors in play in northeastern Nigeria. First is long-term effects of desertification and the shrinkage of Lake Chad. Lake Chad today is a tiny fraction of what it was a generation ago. That has tremendous impacts on the ability to irrigate, thus arable land, as well as other livelihoods, including fisheries, which is a major source of protein in the region. So that's a long-term crisis that has to be confronted. Boko Haram insurgency made it worse by essentially depopulating the land, where numbers are upwards of 3 million people at least displaced within northeastern Nigeria alone. These are people who are driven off the land during the period when the Boko Haram insurgency spread and took control of large parts of Borno and neighboring states. Now, the Nigerian forces are not large enough to totally control the area provides security, so people are not necessarily returning. So that displacement may be a permanent factor, and that will have implications for ongoing food security, not just the crisis of the moment.
Anything to add or subtract on the northern Nigeria?
I fully agree with that. It's a good answer to famine is not only the emergency relief, providing food to people who are about to starve, but it is also working on resiliency of these communities to recover and to be stronger when the next cycle of famine comes. And of course, if they have been displaced on their land and insecurity does not allow them to go back, they will remain displaced in a protracted manner. And that means the cycle of need will just be repeated year after year. And I think one of the difficulties we find right now is that while in the first months we want to respond to the immediate needs of people who are about to starve, we are not able to put in place the programs that would address this question of resiliency.
As we close, back to you, J. Peter Pham, and I saved South Sudan for last because it is truly a tragic situation since, at least as Stephen O'Brien, the humanitarian coordinator for the United Nations, has said, the famine in South Sudan is man-made for the most part. I mean, this is a country that could be a breadbasket, not only for its own people, but for perhaps the region. Two counties in South Sudan are in what is called phase five famine situation. You know the situation very well. Do we see any breakthrough with respect to this conflict? Because this is truly man-made.
Very much so. And I lay the responsibility at the door of the government there. Certainly, the rebel forces, those in opposition, have their own responsibility and need to be accountable for. But let's face it, this crisis began in December 2013. What was a political crisis was turned into an open conflict by the incumbent government's attempt to eliminate the opposition, which drove them to take up arms. Not justifying taking up arms, but let's be honest, they were driven to it. Secondly, it's continued with the government doing things like government troops looting humanitarian warehouses, taking supplies meant for people, raising the visa fees to $10,000. I think it's unconscionable to try to make money off of this. And South Sudan, 85, 90% of the land is arable. Less than 15% has even been cultivated. This is a country that, unlike the others, is not suffering necessarily drought or desertification. It could produce and feed itself in the entire region, but no one's going to plant if they don't know that they're going to be there or not at harvest time. Be totally irrational. So it is driven by the government, and I think the government needs to be held account to that by the international community.
Do you see any signs of change in terms of, you know, their behavior? Is anybody putting pressure on them? Does anybody have leverage to put pressure on the government?
Interestingly, in recent weeks, we've seen defections from both the government and from the SPLM-IO, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, in opposition to yet another movement. And now, while the creation of yet more parties to the conflict is not necessarily helpful, one sees that it's breaking down from a binary path. But really, at the end of the day, we need a change there. The amount of money that the government itself admits its own minister stole in the last few years would actually satisfy the deficit in the appeal for aid for all four countries. But this money has been squirreled away by the very people who are entrusted with governing on behalf of their people.
And the last word to you, Michel Gobaudon, particularly as a former UN official, I'd like to get your perspective on how we can break this deadlock in South Sudan.
Well, certainly I agree with Peter that the leaders of Southern Sudan has betrayed their people to an extent that we cannot describe. It's really unconscionable. The violence that is vested among civilian population is absolutely horrendous, with levels of violence against women in particular that we've hardly seen before. And we were recently in Uganda to look at the massive arrival of Southern Sudanese who are fleeing, and the stories we got were just horrendous. So it's not just famine leading to starvation, it's famine leading to even more conflict, and that conflict debords into this horrific violence against civilians. The response by the UN and by the Ugandan government has been quite good in Uganda, but they are now threatened by lack of funding also. And the difficulty for the UN is going to say, where do we prioritize the money right now? Do we save an operation that works pretty well by funding it well so it doesn't sort of stall? Or do we distribute the funds a little bit more equanimously between all the different areas, even in areas where we think we're going to be less efficient? That's a tremendous difficulty for Mr. Ryan and for the Secretary General on how to allocate funds. on the Secretary General, I cannot say what he will do. He certainly, when he was High Commissioner for Refugees, kept on saying the humanitarians do not have the solution to the misery we have to address. The politicians have it, and they have to be accountable for that. He has gone to the AU, to the African Union, to talk to them, to say, what pressures are you going to put to these leaders? And he's probably trying to do the same with the Western countries who have been supporting the Southern Sudanese government and who should be called for its actions very, very abruptly.
Well, gentlemen, on that rather somber note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, J. Peter Pham, the Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Michel Gabaudon. He's President of Refugees International. Thank you both for your wonderful insights.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Jonah Cummings. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.